It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. We have Madison Magazine senior editor Maggie Ginsburg out with her debut novel set in the fictional town of Anthem, Wisconsin, with about 1,600 residents perched on the edge of our state's famed Driftless region is the setting. One of the newcomers to Anthem and a journalist by trade, the character Claire Taylor, puts it this way. In a town this size, every story had already been told. She knew no one. She'd be starting from nothing. The themes explore alcoholism and drinking culture, family secrets and love. Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Maggie Ginsburg, author of Still True, out from University of Wisconsin Press. Maggie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, Kate. Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here and excited to talk about the book and grateful
yes.
to you for having me.
Well, you know, let's talk about Anthem, Wisconsin first and the setting. Why set your first novel in a familiar Midwestern setting?
Well, they say write what you know.
And, yes, they do.
and I love, you know, books and stories that are have a sense of place where the town is a character as well. And I think that when you grow up in places like this, you maybe don't even realize how much the town plays a role in your identity and who you are. And it's kind of hard to separate who you are and the things you do from the town itself. And I think that people who came up the way I did understand that and recognize that. And so Anthem isn't real, but it's very real to me.
I learned you wrote with a map next to you on your desk. How did that help with writing and getting this out?
Well, it really was a real place to me. And so I needed to sketch it out and I needed to understand that if Claire walked up this street, she was going to see this opera house versus if some of the other characters, there's a lot of walking in the book.
If
some
is.
Of the other characters, you know, if Lib walked to her house 2 miles from her husband's house out on the edge of town, I needed to know where the water tower was and what she could see when she looked back. And so, and a lot of things center around Cafe Carolina. And I just needed to get my bearings and it needed to feel accurate to me.
That whole walking thing. I mean, my brain didn't allow me, Jack and Lib being married for 33 years, didn't allow me to have them live separately. Like, I didn't believe you, author, at first. Like, you know, Lib starts out walking to Jack's house. I'm like, oh, yeah, they're divorced. I mean, it was like this assumption in my mind. And so it really took me a while to accept that they live separately. What? Why did you do that?
Well, I saw the character of Lib first. I could see her very clearly in that farmhouse and, you know, fiercely independent, but also married. And so who would that be who she was married to? And that is where Jack came from. And I just started to see them and think about them and what that looked like. I am in a second marriage and we have yet to live together. So it's been just about 10 years that we've done it this way. And our reasons are very different from Lib and Jack's. And we live an hour apart, not a 2 mile walk apart. And we each have kids and that's just what made the most sense for our families. But what I noticed is that, you know, we get a lot of questions, a lot of questions about that. People almost instantly ask when they find out that we don't live together, well, why did you get married? And much like Jack says in the book, you know, the question stuck in my craw because, you know, if I'm just meeting a couple for the first time, you know, who live together, I never ask them why they got married. but you know, to people that, closer to, you know, I do think it's a fair question, an interesting question, and one we certainly gave plenty of thought to, you know, before entering that marital contract.
I'm not sure. I was thinking too, you know, as a novelist, there's some convenience factor in that you can make a lot of plot happen where the spouse can realistically not see.
Exactly. And we did have kind of a funny conversation toward the beginning of my writing where we were out for pizza one night. And I said, so if I were hiding an adult child in my basement, How long do you think, could I get away with it for a month, say? And of course, he just didn't even blink. He's like, yeah, I think you probably could. So I knew that it was interesting to people. And that was a jumping off point. And it just made sense to me to put Lib and Jack in this position and send them down the 30 years down the road and think about what might come between them. Because Lib, you know, has a lot of secrets and Jack is a stickler for honesty.
I'm gonna
a good spot to start.
a good spot. Yes. I'm gonna reintroduce you here for a moment. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin author and journalist Maggie Ginsberg, out with her debut book, Still True, talking about the new novel, exploring themes of family secrets and forgiveness, alcoholism, and this little town of Anthem, Wisconsin, fictional town. You can join in 800-642-1234. Talking about the secrets, the story involves Lib's distant past catching up with her. She became pregnant as a teenager by a much, much older man and just unfolding a lot of pain. What do you hope readers learn from Lib's experience?
I thought a lot about that question because I wasn't thinking about it as I was writing. It was Lib's experience. And now that it's out there in the world, I'm needing to think about, you know, why she did the things she did and how I think, although this is completely fictional, you know, there are a handful of things in my life that I've spent most of my life thinking about just because of my own experiences. And one of those is, you know, what it's like to the women of that particular generation. So, you know, there were a lot of girls in the 50s and 60s who got pregnant as teenagers, and they were sent away to live at homes, a Salvation Army home for unwed mothers. There was a Catholic version as well. Mm-hmm. And there's a book called The Girls Who Went Away, The Hidden History of Women Who Surrendered Children for Adoption in the Decades Before Roe v. Wade by Ann Fessler, that tells the stories of these girls. And my mom was one of those girls. And so I just know from growing up this way, And it was a happy story. I gained a sister when I was only, when I was 14. Mm. And so that's been happy, but I've also just been very aware of this sort of silent, a different way of that generation being silent. And I think there are a lot of those stories that still haven't been told. And now that is not what Lib did. There was no adoption and Lib was not sent away. But I think about the trauma and the unaddressed trauma that those women went through, those young girls went through. And I think that that definitely informed Lib's life and her choices and the things that she decided were no one's business but her own when she came back to Anthem to rebuild her life. Mm-hmm. And that included Jack. When she met him a few years later, she just wasn't going to tell him those things. And honestly, she didn't want to tell them to herself either. She just wanted to erase it all and act as if none of it had ever happened and move forward.
It felt just like she had lived a lot of life before those 25 or so years. I mean, then just to fast forward, you know, Lib's adult son, Matt, showing up on her doorstep and just thinking about how that is when, you know, an infant has left you and then suddenly reappeared in your life nearly 40 years later. It was really fascinating as you, unwound that and how they had mannerisms that matched even, and they didn't even realize and you do it in such subtle, graceful ways. I really appreciated that. But that to me was really fascinating just to have that meeting so many decades later.
Mm-hmm. When my mom and my sister met, they have the same thumbs and they do the same thing with the edge of a blanket with their thumbs, and they have identical handwriting. So that was, I've just always been really fascinated by the sort of magic of DNA, just like I'm fascinated by what the families we choose and what makes a family and the sort of meanings that we attach to different relationships and conventions and, you know, just like needing to live in the same house to be a true married couple. You know, I just like thinking about those things. And so their relationship exemplified that for me. And I also like thinking about the role of alcohol and addiction mm-hmm. in people's lives. And it's kind of all over this book, even though that was never my intention. And, you know, one of the kind of hallmarks of that, as Matt is someone who has struggled with alcohol and addiction, is what things he's holding Lib responsible for. The, mm-hmm. you know, this person that he has never met. For 40 years, he's had a life that had nothing to do with her, but she's his mom, and he's holding her responsible for a lot of things instead of himself. And I found that really interesting to think about too.
Author and journalist Maggie Ginsberg's first novel is called Still True. Join in on fiction set in Wisconsin, complex characters and how they speak to you in the novels you love and what you want to know about writing inspiration and getting that debut novel published. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring the new novel, Still True, that is set in fictitious rural Wisconsin, alcoholism. It is a dimension of these complex characters. Maggie Ginsberg writes about Claire, the mom of 10-year-old Charlie. She was exhausted just thinking about alcohol, and there could be no more outrunning the truth. She had said she wouldn't drink again, and then she did. She failed the simplest test. Join in, 800-642-1234. Author Maggie Ginsberg stays with us. Alcohol is all over this book. What did you set out intending that, or how did you weave alcoholism and drinking culture in like this?
Yeah, not at all, actually. In the first draft, actually, in the first many, many drafts, and well after I had my agent and the book was out on submission, Claire wasn't a drinker. So I know it was, she was just sort of moving through her life, unhappy and, you know, making some questionable decisions. And one day my agent called and she said, you know, these characters are really fully formed. They feel like real people, but there's something missing with Claire and I can't put my finger on what it is. And so I went to a couple of my friends, my early readers, and I read through it again. And I was just trying to think, what is going on? What is missing? And then when it dawned on me, it was so obvious. She's got a problem with drinking. And then it became very easy to write that layer in and just wove it throughout. And it just made nothing really changed about the story. It just made it all make sense in a way that I probably had been avoiding just because it hit a little too close to home.
Makes sense. And so scary too. I mean, you watch Claire go through denial. The line goes, clearly alcohol wasn't a problem for her, but more like a medicine. How was it any different than an antidepressant? Depressant, really? And that's when I swallow as a reader and say, oh no, oh no. Because you really, I mean, so many of the scary moments of this book really revolve around alcohol and addiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. With a lot of grace and a lot of help, I was able to quit drinking in 2010. And I think I would have asked for help sooner if I had related, if I'd seen myself in books or on TV or just out there in the world, but I didn't relate. I didn't think that there were other, you know, young married moms with jobs and a car and friends who appeared to be doing just fine, but were waking up every morning saying, okay, today is the day I'm going to quit drinking, and then going to bed every night, you know, hating myself for this broken promise that only I knew I'd made. You know, it wasn't these big, scary things happening yet. And so when I did finally see myself in a couple of examples in literature, and in other women I connected with out in the world, that made such a difference. And so I didn't think about it. And then now that the book is finished and out there, I can see it all over this book. And I think it's just, I've gotten really used to living in a world without alcohol, so that I don't even think about it, much like I didn't think about it before, because in Wisconsin, it is just pervasive. I mean, it's just the air we breathe. And I think if you have only ever lived in Wisconsin, you don't even know it. And that's another thing that I had grown up with as well. And I love Wisconsin. I have to say, you know, I love Wisconsin. My husband and I are proud UW alums. Both of our parents are. We each have a sibling who is. My oldest daughter is third generation Badger. So I've got a lot of love for Wisconsin, but this is a challenging place to be a non-drinker, and you don't really have that awareness until you are trying to quit. It's ubiquitous. It's just, and it's not just college. It's every book club and fundraiser and wedding and funeral and school function and parent group. And, you know, it's all centered around alcohol. My dad is from New York. He met my mom at UW, and then they moved to Northern Minnesota, which is where I was born. But after they had three kids, my mom wanted to move back to Wisconsin to be closer to family. And my dad loved Wisconsin. But his primary concern was raising his kids in such a pervasive drinking culture that he said he was very aware of coming from the outside, but that people who grew up in it really weren't aware of it. And, you know, he still talks about his beloved Manitowoc boys, his college roommates, but he'd never seen drinking like that in his life. So, you know, for the kids that grow up here, it's just the air we breathe. And I think about that with my kids and going to college. And so I don't think I was thinking about it when I wrote the book, and yet I was obviously thinking about it everywhere, all over every character.
Wisconsin author and journalist Maggie Ginsberg with us, out with her debut novel, Still True. You can join in 800-642-1234. You know, I also get frustrated, and moving on in a moment from alcohol, but I get frustrated that the people, you know, like Claire's spouse doesn't do anything about the drinking and drinks himself. And you bring out the denial in other ways, like the clerk of the liquor store asks having a cookout when Claire is buying just tons of hard alcohol. And she says, you bet. There is like this, even this pervasive denial of it.
But I do think, you know, in all fairness, that it starts with Claire. Mm-hmm. It started with myself. You know, when you do have that strong level of denial, when alcohol is something that you are really in a relationship with, that you love as a person, that you're very protective of, then you are telling yourself a lot of things. And not just with alcohol in this book, a lot of the characters are telling themselves a lot of things about who they are and what it all means. And you protect that in ways that are really subtle and subconscious that you just really don't realize. And you surround yourself with people who love you and are going to, sort of defend that with you without knowing that that's what they're doing. You know, because that's the subtle art of relationships. I mean, we just, we're, especially if we're smart and, you know, we're just really good at believing what we want to believe.
Mm. You mentioned early readers. Did you get enough writing advice and support along this road to finishing your first novel?
Oh my gosh. I have had so much support. Writing is so strange. In some ways, you're all by yourself. You know, the candle and I wrote this book in the early morning hours, 5 to 7 a.m., you know, before my day job, in the winter, and it was dark, and I felt all by myself. But at the same time, I had all of these writing teachers and writing friends who were really supporting me and who I could send pages to, and formally and informally. I was in a writing program with Erin Salello and Anne Garvin, and that was instrumental in writing this first book. And, you know, writers before that, Kathy Steffen, writing teachers after that, Susanna Daniel and Michelle Wilgen, author friends after that. I mean, people are,
they're
Wisconsin
everywhere.
Writers
but
are
what
amazing.
About rejection? I mean, what about shopping a book? Any advice there?
That is a really, really, really difficult, probably one of the most unfun times of my life was, and I amassed some absolutely beautiful rejections from some absolutely incredible editors. And my agent was really careful. And so it didn't necessarily go out to a whole lot of people, but she took her time. And it was a long, lonely time where you just try not to be obsessive and you try to keep writing, because all roads lead back to writing. You know, if the mm-hmm. book is published and becomes an overnight sensation, that they're going to say, when's your next book? If the book is not published, you can't get a deal for it, then it's when, what's your next book? So if you are a writer, unfortunately, you can look for all kinds of ways out, but really all there is to write. And so it's a good thing that I've always loved it, because I don't have plans to do anything else. But
Maggie, I'm sorry, we are out of time, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This has been wonderful. And I'm just so grateful that you're helping this book find its readers. It is a love letter to Wisconsin. And like all love letters, it's a complicated one.
Maggie Ginsberg, author of Still True. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a story about Wisconsin's massive creatures.
Have you ever wondered what the biggest animal in Wisconsin is? If so, you're a lot like Alston Van Overmeer of Mineral Point. When he was in fourth grade, he asked WPR's Wisconsin Project to find the answer for him. So WPR's Colleen Leahy went to track down the state's biggest animals.
The first time you see a blue whale, it's a life-changing experience.
Oh my God!
Weighing up to 400,000 pounds, the blue whale is the largest animal that's ever existed in the history of planet Earth.
Oh my God!
Oh my God, yeah!
Oh my God.
I haven't seen a blue whale myself. Those people you just heard, having the times of their lives, were in California and Mexico. This is Wisconsin. So, I took a trip to see the biggest animal America's Dairyland has to offer, a bison.
Like, how many do you have?
Right now, between 60 and 70. Greg Cumrow, Farmers Battle Creek Beef and Bison LLC. We raise bison and sell the meat.
At 6 feet tall and weighing a ton or more, I still got the philosophical fix I was looking for from Cumrow's herd of bison. The animals were majestic. They humbled me. They helped me remember that we humans are minuscule. We are but a blip in Earth's 4.5 billion year history.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. It's coming closer. Is it like safe to be close, get close to them?
No.
Now that I'd proved myself to be a bona fide farm girl, Carmer decided I was ready to talk shop and see the behind the scenes of his operation for myself.
Well, I have New York strips, ribeyes and tenderloins, chuck roast, sirloin chip roast, rump roast, brown roast, bratwurst, summer sausage, stew meat. You know, there's just about any cut you can find in beef you can find in bison.
Whoa. Even though they often end up in the freezer, it's easy for bison to be the heavyweight champion in Wisconsin because they also hold the title of largest land animal in all of North America. But wait, there's actually another big Wisconsin animal I haven't told you about yet, and that is moose. Unlike bison, which are all captive in Wisconsin, moose are wild, but they're very rare. The Department of Natural Resources says there are probably fewer than 20 moose in the entire state, most of them up north, which is too bad. But you know what's even worse than not having many moose? Not having any whales. There aren't any whales in the Great Lakes today. Sure, I can accept that. But I had trouble believing that there were never whales in our past and that there won't ever be whales in our future. So I asked a whale expert, straight up, are whales just never going to happen for us?
The scenario for the Midwest isn't totally outlandish, I think. There could have been whales in Wisconsin.
That's Nick Pyonson, curator of fossil marine mammals at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History and author of the book Spying on Whales.
So if you want to get whales into the Midwest, one way is to just wait until sea level gets high enough.
sea levels high enough that whale barriers like waterfalls and locks and dams would be eliminated, allowing Canadian whales in the St. Lawrence River to swim down to Lake Erie. That's probably not going to happen, though, at least not in my geologic lifetime. But that's okay. With no whales in sight, I eventually came around the idea that Wisconsin's biggest animal, the bison, is a pretty decent backup.
Look at the little faces!
I think they're majestic.
I was just about to say that.
WPR's Colleen Leahy brought us that story on Wisconsin's biggest animals. And this story came from an audience question as part of WPR's Wisconsin Project. Send us your questions and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we explore pharmaceutical tech transfer and the process of bringing new drugs to market with the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery, which helps further the drug development research of UW-Milwaukee faculty. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, approved 50 novel drugs last year. Join in on the research, the testing, and the manufacturing of innovative drugs, 800-642-1234. Alexander Arnold is director of the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery, vice president of the Milwaukee drug development startup Pantherix. Alexander, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Having me, Kate.
Good morning. We also have Doug Stafford, CEO of Pantherix, formerly led the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery. Doug, welcome to you.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good morning. So, Doug, starting with you and developing this new anti-inflammatory drug aiming to control asthma without inhalers, how was this compound discovered?
Well, through a long process of research. For every drug, there needs to be a target within the body that the drug interacts with. And the early stages occurred through a collaboration with Columbia University to identify a new target in the lung. And then the group in Milwaukee really took on the chemistry to design a drug through Alexander's work. And so the innovation, the spark of innovation occurred within the university laboratory setting.
So where is it in the development process?
We're about to begin human clinical trials. And so we're the final stages of what's called preclinical research. And after that, we would proceed to clinical studies in human beings under FDA guidance.
And so during a new drug's early preclinical development, your goal obviously to determine if the product is reasonably safe for initial use in humans. And I'm always curious, how do you do that exactly?
Through a number of studies, and they're typically begin with studies in cell culture, where then it moves on to various animal models, normally in rodents. Typically, diseases are capitulated in animal models, and so you can learn a lot about how the drug might work in human beings by studying it in a mouse.
Alexander, so Doug had mentioned Columbia University there in the mix of bringing this to UW-Milwaukee's Institute for Drug Discovery. It can take a decade or more for drugs to come to market. How do you know when it'll be worth the cost, the time, the bench science to create a new drug?
Yeah, I think the kind of like litmus test in order to see if a compound is really market ready is in the development, where a lot of groups, you mentioned Columbia University, are working together. And, you know, in order to have money to support this work, we are submitting grants, which get reviewed by national, international researchers. And they're giving us a really good feedback about what the invention looks like and if the invention is actually ready for the next step. So we really rely on our peers in order to tell us that, you know, we are ready for the clinical trials. And if we have conducted our preclinical trials sufficiently in order to make sure that a new compound is safe enough in order to be administered to a human.
So where do you look to get the funding to carry out the bench science and to move the drug development along to next phases? Is it mostly through grants, or are there private dollars too?
Yeah, so it's mostly grants in the beginning. The NIH is the institutes of the NIH are very, very important for drug discovery. They are internal grants from the university in order to support their researchers. But you know what you mentioned, yeah, the private market is very important. So we are looking for investors in order to, you know, come up with money and I'm talking here about significant money in order to support these clinical trials.
And when you say significant, what is, you know, for the average drug, was necessary in order to support clinical trials?
It depends on what kind of phase you are. You know, there are three phases, clinical phases, and they are all affiliated or all related to a particular dollar amount where it's increasing over time. And it also depends on the indication. There are some indication where the clinical trials are broader. Here we're talking tens of millions of dollars. And other indications are smaller, where you have a smaller population of patients. And so, you know, these are a little bit less money intensive.
Yes. You know, Doug, so Pantherix recently received this grant from the NIH for more than $250,000 and aiming to help the company, the startup, develop this oral version of your anti-inflammatory drug. What does grant money like this go toward as you look at moving this research along?
It really helps with validation of the concept. And so the drug started off with very early research. And as you move ahead, there needs to be increasing validation that this, in fact, can be a human pharmaceutical to justify the really significant cost of moving that towards FDA approval. So this money helps validate. And as Alexander said, you know, part of the grant process is not just the money, but it's the affirmation through experts in the field that this is really a compelling areas of research. And so we see that as important steps in the process, as well as allowing us to fund important steps of the process. This recent grant will pay for the oral formulation, and that is taking the compound, which is a chemical, and putting it into a pill form that is necessary to advance the product into human testing.
And, you know, this is definitely a step away from inhalers, which is a really common way of treating asthma. Is the oral approach, do you think, is that unique or a niche that is worth going toward?
Yeah, there are other oral drugs that are used for asthma. However, we feel that our drug could compete with the typical inhalers that are used as the first line control of asthma. As you probably know, most people don't use asthma inhalers correctly. The drug doesn't go into the lung as it should. Many people don't use the inhalers. And we think that an oral drug that could be, say, taken once a day instead of the inhaler would be a much better therapy. We talk about drug compliance, and that is the taking of the drug as prescribed. We think an oral drug would have much better compliance than the inhalers. And also, because of the novelty of the mechanism of the drug action, we think there would be far fewer adverse effects compared to the steroids, for example, that are commonly in the inhalers.
We're talking about drug development with Doug Stafford there and Alexander Arnold. Doug leads a Milwaukee-based drug development startup working on this novel anti-inflammatory drug. Alexander oversees the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery, working with UW-Milwaukee institutions and researchers. Join in on pharmaceutical R&D here in Wisconsin, where you find opportunities, where you find roadblocks, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We look at pharmaceutical drug development happening in Milwaukee. According to the journal Nature, the FDA approves about 51 drugs a year. That's its five-year average. A decade ago, the average was 24 novel therapeutics approved a year. Join in on the tech transfer, the R&D of innovative drugs, 800-642-1234. Alexander Arnold and Doug Stafford, they run a Milwaukee drug development startup, and Alexander also leads the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery. They stay with us. I want to talk a little bit, Alexander, about tech transfer and how your institute approaches tech transfer or moving like the manufacturing and the analytics, the documentation, the patents, the expertise from one phase to the next or from one lab to another as more companies or labs get involved. What is that like?
Yeah, so the process starts, as you said, Kate, in the laboratory. And, you know, in the laboratory, if you're working there, an invention comes very easily and suddenly. And if this is happening in your laboratory, you would contact the UWM Research Foundation, who would support you in order to convert that invention into a patent. And this is probably like the first step in this many steps of drug discovery. Now, in the laboratory itself, we're also looking for advice in respect to how do we really advance a compound. And there, the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery is very important, which is a collaborative institute with many expertise. And so we can really guide investigators in order to make the next steps. Now, after we have a patent, the next step would be in order to do the preclinical trials. And this is something which the Institute is supporting. So we developed an infrastructure at UWM Milwaukee where investigators can now take advantage of this network and of this infrastructure to do the next steps. And myself as a director, I'm really into the midst of it in order to have personal conversation, to suggest what to do next, and, you know, looking for funding opportunities in order to make those happen.
Communication is such underlying so many of these processes. Doug, do you feel that type of support as you try to launch this particular drug? I mean, what are your thoughts on tech transfer and that road to commercialization?
Yeah, I mean, even though the technology now has been licensed into a company, the company still relies heavily on the university expertise. A startup company cannot go out and hire 100 people right off the bat to do this. And so there's continual connection with the university as far as helping and develop methods for scale-up manufacturing, for analytical types of work, for validation in early preclinical studies and the like. And so that's a continual linkage. And so that, and the inventors of the technology are also part of the company. And so while there's been essentially a handoff to the company for later stage development, the linkages with the expertise at the university will always be essential.
Is there enough pharma industry around you here in Wisconsin in order to do this work? Or like in some industries, it helps to be elsewhere. How do you feel about that?
Well, Wisconsin, in fact, does have some really outstanding capabilities in pharma. For example, compound manufacturing or drug manufacturing is really a strength in Wisconsin. There's also great capabilities for preclinical toxicology work, for bioanalytical work to support preclinical and clinical studies. And so there's actually a lot right here. It may be a little bit behind the scenes, but we take great advantage of those companies and also the expertise that's here in Wisconsin. And while the industry is not large by any stretch compared to, say, coastal areas, there is great capabilities right here.
We're talking about drug development and that process with Doug Stafford and Alexander Arnold. Doug is the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery's former director, runs Pantherix, a Milwaukee-based drug development startup. Alexander Arnold runs the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery. You can join in 800-642-1234. Alexander, more than 90% of clinical drug development fails to produce a drug that goes to market. So what happens if, like, what you're working on, something that you've put your heart and soul and everything into, what if it fails human trials? What is that like?
Yeah, what is it like, Kate? That's a really good question. Yeah, there is some disappointment there, but we know the process and we know about the high failure rate. So what we do in order to counteract this is not to put all eggs in one basket, but we are looking, for instance, for the compound we are developing, if there might be some other indications where we see some positive results. So concentrating on asthma is one strategy, but also concentrating on patients where this compound might be efficacious could work in favor if a clinical trial with asthma would fail. Now, another strategy is to maybe look at different kind of compounds with different kind of profiling. And this also allows you to have a backup compound, which you could then advance in case that your primary lead compound would fail in clinical trials. So having backup plans, having like a plan in place if something where you want to is the strategy which is currently used in drug discovery.
Okay. Doug, research published in the American Chemical Society says academic inventors or drug company founders contributed to more than a quarter of all medicines approved by the FDA from 2001 through 2019. What impact have you seen from the rise of academic contributions to new drug development?
Yeah, that transition had occurred over the last 20 or so years, where a majority of drug discovery happened in large pharmaceutical companies. But when you think about it, how is innovation best carried out? And you know, what's playing out from the statistics you just read is that innovation occurs in small, nimble organizations that are accustomed to risk, but can take chances. And if an idea comes up, you can go into the laboratory and test it, as is happening in the Institute of Milwaukee. And so we're seeing that really playing out, is that small, nimble groups in academia or in small biotech companies are coming up with the ideas and essentially take them to the point of validation. And then at that point, it's quite typical to hand off the technology to the large pharmaceutical companies for the very large, expensive, complex clinical trials. So I think the innovation aspect of this is really quite real.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Alexander Arnold leads the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery. Doug Stafford is its former leader, and they're executives at the Milwaukee drug development startup Pantherix, working on that asthma anti-inflammatory drug. Just ahead, we get a preview of major Broadway productions around Wisconsin and check in with local theater companies. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.